This is Howard Boxer for Now News and Events. Longtime Concordia instructor Craig Morrison delivered a lecture called The Beatles and the Montreal Connection at Concordia's J.A. DeSev Cinema on September 28th, part of the university's Homecoming 2012 festivities. Morrison covered the Beatles' history as well as the group's and John Lennon's ties to Montreal.
So it's great to be here, and it's great to have you with us, and today you're going to hear a little bit about all of this. So let's get going, all right? You probably have many images of the Beatles when you think of them. This is, of course, a later one where they're a little bit more scruffy. I'm going to work my way up towards how they got to be the Beatles and then how they got to Montreal. And then later on, I'm going to talk about the other Montreal connection, because there's two Montreal connections. One is they played here, and a lot of people have still fond memories. Was there anybody here that was actually at that concert in 1964? Montreal Forum. So none of us have fond memories of it. But the other event was the John Lennon and Yoko Ono bed in. Was anybody in that bed? Besides John Lennon and Yoko Ono. Okay, so let's meet the Beatles, shall we? Now, this was a fabulous photograph, often copied, but in Canada and the States and Britain, they had different album covers showing up in different contents sometimes of those albums, so you may realize, oh, that's the Canadian one, or that's not the Canadian one, but just we'll go through. I chose this one for the title, Let's Meet the Beatles, all right? A good party question is, can you name all the Beatles? You can actually make some money with that question, because it's a bit of a trick, because there's more than just four of them. Pete Best, yeah. And there was actually another, there was another one. Stuart Sutcliffe. So, you know, you can make some money, you know. Come on, for $10, name all the Beatles. Okay, I've contrasted some earlier and slightly later photographs when we go through these. This is, on Ed Sullivan, there was a little sign that said, sorry girls, he's married. A nice, beautiful early photograph of Paul up there in the corner. Now Sir Paul. The baby of the group. How they began, I'm going to go through this fairly quickly. They were, it depends on how famous, but they were in their early 20s, for the late teens, early 20s, when they really started to get popular. Yeah. This is a photograph of John Lennon in 1957. This is the famous The Day That Paul and John Met. He's playing for a church event. And this is a folk music group, and it's known as, the style was known as skiffle music. It was a British kids imitating American folk music. And you can see there's a guy playing a wash tub bass, which is like a broomstick with one string on it. Dum, 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 dum. You pull the handle to get more tension on the string. This is very, very early, but it was a craze in Britain at that time, and many people who later became famous actually got their start in skiffle music. Perhaps you're a Led Zeppelin fan. If you write James Page Skiffle Group, you can see a film clip of Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin doing this kind of music also. They met that day, and very soon Paul was in the group. This is the first photograph of the two of them together, and they still have the guy in the back with the broomstick bass, the one-string bass. But those fellows parted ways. They remained friends, but they brought in George, quite a bit younger, but quite good on the guitar. Now, there was a connection between Liverpool, which is where they were from, and Hamburg, and you can see on the map, they're kind of beautifully side by side. Hamburg in Germany was called at one time the cradle of British rock, and the reason for that was there were so many British groups that went there to perform. They went to perform because there was an American forces base nearby, and also people in general around the world were crazy about rock and roll music, and the London groups were a little farther away, or at least a little more expensive. So the Liverpool groups, many of them served an apprenticeship there, and the Beatles actually learnt so much of their craft by having to play songs for a wide range of people. Songs that would include pop songs from the 30s and rock songs from the 50s. And as they learnt them, you can almost see in some of their songs, they got that idea from this song. They just kind of imported those ideas. It became part of their vocabulary. When they were first performing there, Pete Best was on the drums. I actually got to see him in Montreal once. And after he left the group, his record company put out an album. Are you ready for this? Best of the Beatles. I don't know how many people bought it, but here's a lovely photograph of them with Stuart Sutcliffe on the right-hand side. He was an art school friend of John Lennon's, but he died tragically in Germany, actually. They were photographed in Germany, and they connected with art school students there who became some of their best friends, and it's the people in the artistic community in Hamburg that convinced them that they should grow their hair long and comb it forward. That's the origin of the Beatle haircut. But you can see at this time they were dressed up in the manner of 50s rockers with the leather jackets and the greasy hard look. Ringo comes in the picture. They actually met, they knew each other from Liverpool. He was in a rival band, but they also were both performing in Liverpool in different bands. And there is one night that was recorded with the Beatles in Liverpool, and Ringo Starr happened to be sitting in with the band that night. He was not in the band at that moment, but the one live recording they made in Hamburg, he's on the drums. How about that? Well, they played at the Cavern Club a lot, which was a stinky, smelly, watery, dirty cellar in Liverpool, which they tore down and later realized, oh, we shouldn't have torn it down. There are so many tourists coming to town to look at it. So they built it back up again. There is a replica if you go to Liverpool. But they played in this club, and they got quite well known for that. And who should see them but their future manager, Brian Epstein. He worked with his family. His parents ran a furniture store, and at the time, records were an accessory for a piece of furniture which you would buy at a furniture store, and that piece of furniture was called a record player. I don't know if you've ever seen one of those, you know, four legs and a big console, and it's all made out of wood, and you open it up, and you would buy those in furniture stores. The first records I ever bought, I bought them in furniture stores. So he ran the record division, and the story goes, one fan came in and asked for a Beatles record. They had recorded backing up another singer in Germany, and some fan came in and asked about it. And he went to see them at the Cavern, thought they had great talent, and became their manager, and then tried to get them a record deal. He had them go all around London. They actually recorded an audition tape for Decca Records, which you can hear on some bootlegs and a little bit on official recordings. And somebody turned them down saying, the days of the groups is over. And that guy, the rest of his life, was known as the guy who turned down the Beatles. but finally, they almost in their last-ditch attempt, they connected with George Martin. And George Martin, to use a kind of a slang expression, he got them. He understood them because he'd been making comedy records with people like Peter Sellers. And Liverpudlians are famous for being great comedians. And he understood their humor and he thought they were charming. And then he heard them play and he said, I think you guys should get a different drummer. And that's when Ringo came in. But he took a chance on them. He was classically trained and he proved to be just a wonderful addition to their network of people that helped them do what they were doing. He played keyboards on some of the recordings and he orchestrated some of their ideas. And that team really got them on the world stage, let's say. Okay. One of the things that their manager, Brian Epstein, did was he cleaned up their image. Now, the cigarette would probably be airbrushed out by now, but We put them in suits, but it wasn't just any suits. It was suits that nobody else wore, suits that did not really have much of a collar, so they were unique. And the groups at that period, most of them wore uniforms. There was nothing unusual to be in a uniform, but to be in a uniform that was unusual set them apart. And, of course, they had these leather boots, which became known as beetle boots, and all of that helped with their image. But they presented a unified image whenever they performed and also on screen. They started recording in London, and their first album they recorded basically in a day. It was what they were used to playing. But later on, they got very much more sophisticated. Some of the instruments are quite now well associated with them. So that takes us up to what they were doing before we really knew about them. Most people found out about them on the Ed Sullivan Show, but actually just a little bit before. The show was one of the most anticipated television shows in the history of television. There was 73 million people that watched it, which was an unheard of number at that time. And they say that on that particular Sunday night, there was no crime in New York City for 1 hour. Because everybody was watching, even the criminals. But Ed Sullivan, his show had been going for years and years. In fact, he'd had Elvis Presley on his show back in 1956. So he was well known. The show was well known. It was a Sunday night variety show. So it was a family tradition. There was something for just about everybody. There would be puppets or a Broadway stage performers or opera or comedy or acrobats. There was something for everybody. But the Beatles record started to be played on the radio a little bit before that. And they were quite different, and people really, really liked them. So a lot of people, like myself as an adolescent at that time, we'd heard them and we just wanted to see them. There's another factor that's often talked about, especially by sociologists, of why this was such an important event. It was only about 10 weeks earlier that President John F. Kennedy had been assassinated. And that was an event that was incomprehensible. It brought a period of mourning and despair and questioning. And 10 weeks later, these guys showed up. In fact, just a little less, because as I said, we heard their records a little bit later, and people were ready for a new breeze of excitement, youthfulness, enthusiasm. So that helps to explain things a little bit in North America, but they'd already been driving people crazy in other places before that, so it doesn't explain everything. So once the Beatles performed on Ed Sullivan, I mean, everything just exploded. They performed live on that time in February 1964, and they played two more weeks in a row, so 3 weeks in a row on the Ed Sullivan Show. The fan frenzy was just insane, as you saw a little bit there. And some unknown journalist coined this expression for this insanity, and he called it Beatlemania. And you can see on this is an album cover, the newspapers say, a new disease. Doctors are powerless. A teenage cult. So, of course, this led to a lot of excitement and discussion and record sales and so forth. And by, this was April of 1964. This never happened before, and it's never happened since. Number one, this is the Billboard magazine. This is the music industry trade magazine with the most prestige. Beatles number one, Beatles number two, Beatles number three, Beatles number four, Beatles number five, and also on that top 100, in the number 31 spot, I saw her standing there. Number 41, From Me to You. Number 46, Do You Want to Know a Secret? Number 58, All My Loving. Number 65, You Can't Do That. Number 68, Roll Over Beethoven. Number 79, Thank You Girl. Domination of the American charts. And on the album charts, same week, number one album, Meet the Beatles. Number two album, Introducing the Beatles. Well, this led a lot of entrepreneurs to try to make a few bucks off this. So these are bubblegum cards. I used to buy these. Lunch boxes, magazines, more Beatles cards. The only authentic Beatle wig. There's an acquaintance of mine in Montreal that tells me he made quite a bit of money off Montrealers buying Beatle wigs that he had put in the order to get manufactured. And the Beatle boots. Fans, the Beatle boots are here. Now, they were not alone. They were just the forefront of what's become now known as the British Invasion. By the way, they don't call it the British Invasion in Britain. They just call it the Beat Groups. But everywhere else we call it the British Invasion. Because up till that point, American music was prominent, and songs from the UK were virtually unknown. In fact, on your fingers and toes, you can count all of the songs that made the charts in about a 10-year period that came from England, and you probably have a few toes left over. It was just like, this was an odd one, and this was an instrumental, and this was a novelty song. And in other words, British music had virtually no effect on the American market until this moment. And then it was just a wave, a tidal wave. And the Beatles, the Dave Clark Five versus the Beatles, and I'm sure none of them said any of this. Dennis says, "We're glad all over." That was one of their song titles. Lenny says, "We beat the Beatles." Mike says, "We've got more class." Dave says, "I'll duel with Ringo." Rick says, "The gals prefer us." Ringo says, "They're just imitations. Five against four, no fair. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Please, oh please." Okay, now let's take it to, that's the prayer. Let's talk about what happened in Montreal. They played only once in Montreal, but they played twice that day. Mardi Soir says, they did not sell all the tickets for the afternoon show. The evening show was sold out. It was also the first day of school. It was also a Jewish holiday. It was kind of an awkward moment for Ringo Starr because someone had decided that they had sent him a note that they were going to assassinate him because he's Jewish. Well, he's not Jewish. But they had sent him this assassination, you know, warning. So he recalls that was the worst performance experience of any, because he spent the entire show hiding behind his cymbals with a plainclothes detective sitting beside him. And he's thinking, what's the guy going to do, jump up and stop the bullet? But nothing happened, except the fans went crazy. But they went less crazy in Montreal than they did in Toronto or Vancouver. Maybe because they decided that there would not be an intermission. There was an afternoon show, and then there was a break, and then there was an evening show. But within the show itself, there was no intermission, and that's where a lot of the agitation had come in the other cities. So maybe that was part of it. Or maybe we're just more polite here. So here's a photograph from that show. Yeah, and the news caption says the group had one of their quietest appearances of their present tour. Well, they played exactly 12 songs in Montreal. You can hear them. These are bootleg records. I've never heard them, but someone's bootlegged it. I'm sure it's not exactly in high fidelity, as it says up there, because mostly what you would hear was screaming. And that is one of the reasons why the Beatles decided that they would stop touring a mere 2 years later. They did their last public performance just 2 years later. So what I want to do is I want to briefly go through the 12 songs that the Beatles performed that day, in order, kind of a simulation. But this one we saw already, and like four of the songs of the 12 that they performed that day were not their own compositions. And it's a nice window for us to see where they got their inspirations from. This was a group called the Isley Brothers that had fame before, during, and even after the Beatles were in existence, because the Beatles broke up. I don't know if you've heard that part yet. But so the Isley Brothers had a long, long, long career, but they did a really lovely version of this song, which was the inspiration for the Beatles to do Twist and Shout. So we see from this that the Beatles are drawing from American black rhythm and blues traditions. And American music in general was the motor behind the British invasion groups. Now, you know all these groups, or most of them. You know the Rolling Stones, right? And who else came in from the British invasion? The Who and... Sorry? Led Zeppelin a little bit later. Herman's Hermits. The Animals, the Hollies, the Kinks, the Yardbirds. Jerry and the Pacemakers. It's the tip of the iceberg. You've named like less than a quarter of the ones that had hits. It just was unbelievable how many. Nobody mentioned the Rolling Stones. They all came in at the same time, within about a year of each other. And they all drew more or less from the same sources. The next song they played was You Can't Do That. And this is a song that's really about jealousy. And in fact, that's a theme that John Lennon revisited later in a couple of songs, including one in his solo career called Jealous Guy. But the song was the flip side of Can't Buy Me Love, but their records were so popular that both sides were getting played on the radio, so the audience would be familiar with that song as well. Okay, I'm gonna test you people out. I'm going to play a piece of a Beatles song, and you tell me what song it is, okay? Wow! I could do that with every note, right? How about this one? This is the bass line. Oh, you're good. Did you hear it? Can you hear it? Try to demonstrate to you just a tiny example, but the Beatles were very, very good at craftsmanship, songwriting. And now, I had said they had done an apprenticeship by playing a lot of other people's music. They did not read music. They were not trained as musicians. They learned from playing. But they learned from playing and thinking about what they were playing. Now, they probably didn't know sometimes the names of maybe the chords or the devices that they were hearing in music, but they knew how to use them. In this song, that was the bass line for All My Loving. When the voice starts, now this is not in my key, so you have to just imagine. Close your... Okay, that's how the melody starts. Close your eyes. Sing it. Close your eyes. Okay, what did the melody do? The closure is the introduction, but from that next note, what did the melody do? Close your... Sing it. Eyes and up. It only rises. The bass at that moment is only falling, so you get this effect. Now, there's a musical term for that. It's called contrary motion. They probably didn't know the term, but they knew how to do it. So, close your... Sing. Eyes and I'll kiss you tomorrow. At the moment the melody is at its highest, the bass line is at its lowest. So they've got that little introduction, close your... And they do this right to a peak moment. The bass can't go any lower, that's the lowest note. And the melody is quite high, and he's ready to turn around and come back down a bit. Contrary motion right off the top. And it's beautiful. There are other moments, for example, in this song. What song is this? Yes. Now, when they start that song, they start with... And they get really excited. And it's a big, big, big tension, right? You're waiting for it to fall into place. Waiting, waiting, we're getting more tense, getting more tense. Oh, yeah. And then they... Well, that big build-up, maybe they learned it from one of those other songs. Do you know that song that we just saw on video? Well, shake it up, baby. Big, big build-up. They learned their lessons from these songs. So that song starts with the big build-up, and then at the moment, oh, yeah, I'll tell you something. Some people say that one of the reasons that their songs were so loved and so purchased was they were so direct. They're not the first songs to talk about I and me and you, but so many of their songs were really direct. She loves you. Do you want to know a secret? Let me tell you. Can't buy me love from me to you. All of this, very, very direct, so the audience could really relate to that. But this little bit right here in that song, right at that moment, you have to be listening closely, but George Harrison, that's another way you can make $10 at a party. Who was the lead guitar player of the Beatles? George Harrison. I didn't know that. Here's your $10. Right at the moment where the low line is, there's a little... So the note here is being approached from below in the low register and from above in the high register. Another tiny little example of contrary motion. They put so much care into their songs. And audiences generally don't know what they're hearing, but they know if people have put time into it. They can hear if people have rehearsed, or you hear these comments. They were really tight. The audience heard that. Why? They were no overnight sensation. They had, what, 6-7 years of playing behind them. There's a connection between this song and, I'll show you, and a song by Roy Orbison. And they had toured with Roy Orbison and apparently heard him writing Pretty Woman in the back of the tour bus. And there's some ideas in that song that show up in Beatles songs. One of them is heard in this song, but very briefly, and that is this use of this particular minor chord. But in I Want to Hold Your Hand, it's even more clear. So, tell me something, I think you'll understand. I'm getting to the part, this part. And when I touch you. You know that one? You want to sing it?
When I touch you, I feel happy inside. It's such a feeling that my love.
Okay, now this is what I played. You can probably hear the melody ringing in your head. Deal. I'll sing that. You sing the Beatles song. Ready?
And
you ready?
And when I touch you, when I woman step away.
They fit together. It's exactly the same. They didn't even change the key. It's a D chord going to a G, going to a C. It's the same. This is my theory, that they lifted good ideas where they found them. Things we said today a wonderful song where Paul McCartney imagines himself older. He did this later in a song called When I'm 64, and wonders what it would be like to think back to this time of right now. Drawing again from the great wellspring of American rhythm and blues and popular music, they do a song by Chuck Berry. I was very confused as a kid because the Beatles sang Can't Buy Me Love, because just before that they'd put out a song called Money. I don't care too much for money, because money can't buy me love. And right after that they put out a song called Can't Buy Me Love. It's like, make up your mind. But here we start to see a seed of something that shows up later, and that is a more spiritual look at things. Here they're just going, there's something more than money. Later on they start to get more specific in that search. We're still in songs that they played in Montreal. Beautiful love ballad, almost like a 1930s style. And all of these songs were playing when you walked in the room, so maybe you noticed them today. But Paul McCartney had inspiration a lot from, especially Paul McCartney, from pop music, earlier pop music, and his father's music, British music hall music. And of course, this fantastic song, When I Touch You, I Feel Happy Inside. It's no wonder adolescents, such as myself at the time, could relate. Boys was a song that they got from a girl group called the Shirelles. It was a song that Ringo sang, and when he sang, people just would erupt in cheers because he was a favorite Beatle. Who was your favorite Beatle? And they also sang at the Montreal show, Hard Day's Night, from their first movie. This is an example of the different packaging in the different countries. And apparently it was an expression of Ringo's, and they wrote a song around it. This carefreeness and the way the film was made have been very influential, and now if you want to have a nice promo photo for your band, it's really good if you're jumping off a building or jumping up and down in a field. And they finished the show with the song that they got from Little Richard. One of the all-time greats of rhythm and blues. And also, when the Beatles, in several of their songs, they go, woo! That's where they got it from. They got it from Little Richard. Must have been something to see them on stage. I never got to see them on stage. I was too young to take the ferry from Victoria to Vancouver. Mom and Dad, I want to go see the Beatles. You're 12. Where are you going to stay? The ferry doesn't come back that late. So I can't go. But what I'm going to do now is in the next few minutes, I'm going to lead you to the second Montreal event, which was the Bed-In. Of course, there was lots of Beatle albums there passing by us in front of our eyes very quickly. This is a very compressed Beatles history. Now, when you get to this point, at the Rubber Soul album, this is one of the moments where you start to see they're thinking about something deeper. They're thinking about something more, and let's hear that. George Martin on this track is playing a keyboard instrument from India called the harmonium, and they had brought in the Indian influence with Norwegian wood, and that became a big hallmark of psychedelic music. The next track is called Tomorrow Never Knows, and it's one of the most psychedelic tracks the Beatles ever did. In fact, I should mention right now I'm teaching a course called Psychedelic Music. I taught it yesterday across the street. I have 90 students, seem to be aged from about 18 to about 22, most of them. Crazy about finding out about psychedelic music. I'm also teaching a history of soul music, and I have 90 students in that class as well. Any of my students here tonight? Hey, hi. Which one are you in? The soul one? Great. They got a little hairier, a little scruffier in this time period. They were taking drugs. They were reading books. They were hearing about Indian philosophy, and they were searching. So let's listen to a bit of this track, Tomorrow Never Knows, where the only Beatle instrument on this is the drums, except some backwards guitar. You have some bird sounds that come from tape loops. You have the sitar. Actually, there's a bass, but you have some violins. It's pretty weird. It's influenced by Timothy Leary's book, The Psychedelic Experience. And in that book, he refers to the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which John Lennon was reading while taking LSD. The voices are really manipulated. John Lennon asked George Martin, "I want the sound of the Dalai Lama and 1,000 monks singing on a hilltop." They've traveled a distance from "I Want to Hold Your Hand." They're thinking of love and life in much larger terms now. This album conquered the entire world, basically. And shortly after that, on the first live global television broadcast, they brought a message to the world. This is, I'm continuing my very rapid Beatles history. You're supposed to kind of go, right, I remember that. They met up with the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who was teaching them a technique known as transcendental meditation. They went to India to be with him. While they were in India, they composed many of the songs that appeared on this album. They also learned how to finger picking style that was taught to them by Donovan, who was also in India with them. And there are many acoustic songs on this album. I'm continuing my very rapid Beatles history. You're supposed to kind of go, right, I remember that. They met up with the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who was teaching them a technique known as transcendental meditation. They went to India to be with him. While they were in India, they composed many of the songs that appeared on this album. They also learned how to finger picking style that was taught to them by Donovan, who was also in India with them. And there are many acoustic songs on this album. While the Beatles broke up, a lot of people blamed Yoko Ono. Turned out there was many, many reasons. I don't buy that one at all. But once John Lennon and Yoko Ono met, they really sparked each other's creativity. They were deeply in love. So they passed, in the Beatles period, they passed from songs about romance, "I Want to Hold Your Hand," "She Loves You," to a much more generalized spiritual vision exemplified by songs like "All You Need Is Love." And after John and Yoko met, they actually decided to promote the idea of peace as a real possibility. They embarked on some of these, it's mentioned here, lying in bed. They called it a bed-in. This was somewhat in relationship to the sit-in protests in the civil rights movement. Nowadays, we see it as part of a long tradition of performance art. Many people at the time thought it was just silly and a gag and kind of discredited it, but it seemed like it had a long reach. Lying in bed and talking about peace, it was, of course, designed to draw the media, and they did. They did it in Amsterdam, and they came to do it in Montreal. Now, they did it in Montreal kind of by default. The second bed-in could not be held in the United States as they originally planned because Lennon was denied entry, so they came to Montreal. The Queen Elizabeth Hotel hosted them for a week, and they invited lots of people to join them, such as Timothy Leary, the so-called Pope of LSD. The singer Petula Clark was there. Rabbi Abraham Feinberg was there. Lots and lots and lots of reporters, hundreds of them. And they knew that. They wanted that. So they drew all these people there to give a message. They even met at one point with Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau. And after the meeting, one of the reporters asked them, you know, "What are you trying to do?" And he basically said, "We want to bring peace. If I smile at you, you might smile back." So he said, that's how it starts. Well, they came to Montreal. It's now a historic moment. In fact, in 2009, 40 years later, the Montreal Museum of Fine Arts put on an exhibition. And at the exhibition, Yoko Ono came to help open it. They reconstructed the space. They had a bed where people could actually go and lie on it. That's why I asked you if you'd lain on the bed. Could have lain on the replica. They had it surrounded by drawings of John Lennon had made, and photos, and one of his guitars, and lots of other Beatle and Yoko Ono related things, but with the theme of peace. There's Timothy Leary in the front, and I have a very, very, very short clip of this, so let's see if we can watch this tiny little clip. The song Give Peace a Chance, which was a hit record, and the first solo hit record for John Lennon, was actually recorded in that hotel room in Montreal. Bagism, shagism, dragism, madism, ragism, tagism, thisism, thatism, ism, ism. All we are saying. Ministers, sinisters, banisters, canisters, bishops and fishops, rabbis and popeyes, bye-bye, bye-bye. All we are saying is the message still resonates and still needs to be said. Revolution, evolution, masturbation, flagellation, regulation, integration, meditation, United Nations, congratulations. John and Yoko, Timothy Leary, Rosemary, Tommy Smothers, Bobby Dylan, Tommy, I think it's supposed to be Cooper, Derek Taylor, he was their publicist, Norman Mailer, Allen Ginsberg, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. The Hare Krishnas were there. Derek Taylor, their publicist, once said, the Beatles, and I think it's a great saying because I don't think that I would contradict it. He once said, the Beatles were the 20th century's greatest romance. George Harrison once said, the Beatles came to save the world from boredom. Yeah, this was the quote. Peace is no violence, no frustration, no fear. If I smile at you, you're liable to smile back. We are smiling at the world. They continued their campaign with big billboards and signs, "War is over, if you want it." They recorded a Christmas song with wishes for everyone, wishes for peace. Well, as we know, John Lennon was murdered in New York City, the city that he had taken up as a place of residence. He was 40 years old. And now, near where he lived is a park, and in the park is a little space where the word imagine is written. And I've been by it a couple of times. It's always got flowers on it. You may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. It seems like he was not the only one. So, just in conclusion, the Beatles came to Montreal in 1964, and they brought with them a vitality and a joy, which was a delight. It was a delight to the young, and some of the older people got it. And years later, John Lennon came back after the Beatles had broken up with a message. And as I've tried to show today, as you go through the Beatles' history, you see how the message and their thoughts and their process developed. Of course, they became more sophisticated musically. They brought in influences from wider areas, India, just for one example. But their maturity in their thought, in their lyrics, Bob Dylan influenced them. In fact, there's a line, I can't hide. You know what song that is? I can't hide. I can't hide. And I want to hold your hand. And he thought they were singing, I get high. So they met in a hotel room in New York City, and he pulled out a marijuana cigarette, and they said, what's that? And he said, you're the guys that sing, I get high. But Bob Dylan influenced their lyrics. In fact, he said to John Lennon once, how come your lyrics mean nothing? This is after having several million selling records around the world. Can you imagine? How come your songs say nothing? Well, right after that, John Lennon started to write other songs. He wrote a song, Help. I need somebody, more of a vulnerable position. And he started, and the others also started writing from a more poetic and more spiritual position until we get to things like All You Need Is Love. And that mission that he carried out after with Yoko wasn't just the music. He really tried, and I'd like to think in many hearts were touched. We have fond memories of the early days. We have fond memories of the later days. So I've enjoyed putting this together. I've enjoyed thinking about the Beatles and listening to their music again, and I hope you've picked up on some of the threads of the musical development and their spiritual, if you can call it that, development, and their general message, and perhaps had some insight as to why people still find them interesting and valid.